Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council continues to be the center of attention as they pass a $3 billion budget and vote to extend the contract of the interim city attorney while offering him a $75,000 retention bonus. City Council's Tijuana Brown, under federal indictment, says an email issued by her campaign manager claiming Brown was not running for re-election wasn't true but was a test, while Council's Victoria Watlington takes issue with the city attorney investigating her allegations of illegal and immoral acts in city government. The transit bill sees some movement in Raleigh. Brooklyn Village faces yet another delay, and the General Assembly sends two bills to Governor Stein that would strengthen the state's cooperation with ICE. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison. Joe Bruno is with us from WSOC-TV. Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he is the managing editor. And Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We are all gathered in front of an audience at WFAE's Community Center for Community Engagement. Yay! Well, we're going to cover the week's news, and we'll soon quell that excitement. It's budget time on Charlotte City Council, and they just said yes to a $3.6 billion budget for the fiscal year. Steve, how much bigger is that budget than last year's?
Goodness, Mike, I don't have the exact number. I think the main figure for people to know is that this is an election year in the city. So there are elections this fall, which means that there is no property tax increase in the budget. If that comes, it will be next year when there is not an election. The budget, I think some of the highlights of the budget, one of the things is the city's lowest paid employees, who are now making $23 an hour, will make $24 an hour. There was a push among council members to bring them even higher, up to $25 an hour, but that narrowly failed in a vote.
And although property taxes aren't rising, Joe, some fees will be. Which ones and by how much? And did that change from the last time we talked about this?
No, every year the Charlotte water, the storm water, and the trash fees go up. There's also a slight tax increase for people who live in municipal service districts like 2 and 3 in Uptown along Tryon Street. So the residents of those condos will see their taxes slightly go up because it's an extra fee Center City Partners wanted for more security in Uptown. But other than that, I think it's about $7 more a year people will pay for trash, water, and stormwater. Nothing too high.
So the budget also includes funding for the city to buy 45 electric vehicles, but Council's Luana Mayfield wants to overlook one particular brand.
We have a number of EV companies out there now. I would prefer if the city of Charlotte moves in a different direction versus purchasing any more Tesla vehicles.
So is Eric, is that a political statement? What is that?
Heavens, Mike, you're going to make me sad on a Friday. I can't imagine. What's Elon Musk up to these days anyway? I think the Doge father might be the motivation for her statement. So I don't find that surprising at all.
And Mary, she did say that she felt the city could make, quote, better choices of tax dollars and identify companies that align with our city's goals and expectations of truly being a welcoming city. When will council make this decision on which brands of electric vehicles they will buy?
Yes, so this was something that they didn't specifically give a date for in the meeting, just that it would be determined at a later time, something to watch for, especially since those purchases are sometimes kind of tucked away in the council's consent agenda rather than voted on as individual items, so it'll be worth keeping an eye out to see who they end up with.
Joe.
Council, or the city of Charlotte, has 178 electric vehicles already, and only 15 of them are Teslas. I think the Charlotte Fire has a bunch of them, and CMPD has a couple. So it's not like we have a ton of Teslas just sitting in the parking lot somewhere. Most of the purchases for EVs have been Ford. I expect that to probably continue. The awkward thing is at least two of them on the dais personally drive a Tesla, so I do wonder what they were thinking when they heard that.
Eric.
Mike, I know you spent your Friday last week listening to the roundup, but I'm going to remind you that we did discuss with Eli hosting that the county budget had passed, and of course it was the second consecutive year of a property tax increase, about 0.96 cents, and it was 1 cent the year before. And then we're talking about these fee increases that Joe was just detailing, and remember it was 1.37 cents for the city last year. So I know everyone's feeling overly wealthy in the room and around the city, but if you feel a little lighter from time to time, that's what's going on.
Here's another reason you might feel a little lighter. Council voted to extend the contract of the temporary interim city attorney, Anthony Fox, not related to the former mayor. They also did that on a 7-3 vote, with council members Dimple Ashmira, Tijuana Brown, and Renee Johnson voting against the agreement. Steve, why?
I think it's interesting to note that in city government, when a high-ranking official leaves for whatever reason, usually the standard procedure is, you know, you have an interim, and the interim comes from with inside the organization. I mean, that's just, that was how it happened. They had a previous interim city attorney a few years ago. This is kind of standard procedure. And the city council at the end of 2024 was prepared to do that and to elevate the deputy city attorney to the top position. But the mayor wanted to go in a different direction, bring in Anthony Fox, a kind of longtime ally, very close to a lot of council members, raises money for them. So anyway, having said that, his contract was going to run until the end of June. Then in February, the mayor kind of called off the search for a new, postponed the search for a new attorney. Now they don't have anyone. They had to extend his contract another 6 months, and it's a pretty good, pretty hefty bill they're going to have to pay.
Yeah, Joe.
I don't want to say we were gaslit, but like during that whole presentation on Monday about the extension of the contract, it was like last month just never happened. Like the presentation from the city to city council, there was no mention of all the controversy. It was just like, oh, Mayor Vial Isles polled council members and heard that he was doing a great job, so we paused the search and we were going to regroup with you guys at a later date. And you know, Renee Johnson, to her credit, was like, you know, we can't ignore what happened last month. I think we should have a reset here and hire somebody new, or, you know, promote the deputy city attorney, have him or her oversee the city.
Or go, you could have a $75,000 bonus. It's really up to you.
We're going to get into all of this. Mary, go ahead.
Yeah, I just think it's also worth noting, in addition to the $75,000 bonus, the deal also includes a provision. So the city said they want to have a new permanent attorney in office by mid-October. And Anthony Fox's extension says that even if someone isn't in office by October 31st, if he's staying into November or December, he will get paid through the end of the calendar year, even if he were to, say, leave on November 10th.
We're throwing around a lot of money recently on city council for separation agreements and settlements and things like that. Let's back up. Anthony Fox, the interim city attorney, was hired to replace Patrick Baker, who was the city attorney. And Steve, I believe you were among the first, if not the first, to break this story. And perhaps his departure was tied to a request that he fulfilled at our behest at WFAE for information that is public record, but they didn't want to release it, but he did, and that seemed to precipitate his departure. Is that relatively accurate?
Yeah, that was definitely a contributing factor. I think it's interesting to note that the current interim attorney, Anthony Fox, has municipal experience, but he spent a lot of his career in the private sector working at Private Poe. And I think just in the last few months, I think all of us can probably attest in dealing with public records that the new interim attorney has more of a private sector interpretation of state law in terms of open meetings and open documents. It really goes counter to the three previous city attorneys that I've covered, Mac McCarley, Bob Hageman, and Patrick Baker. And I think that council and the mayor, I think, are more comfortable with that. I think they want a tighter, you know, they want kind of a tighter flow of information that comes out to the public. And I think they're pleased with his view of how the city should move forward with requests.
But do we know the terms of Patrick Baker's departure, the monetary terms?
He was paid a full year. His contract called for him to be paid 6 months upon his departure. He was given an extra 6 months in part because news of his he was essentially pushed out. News of that was reported in the media, and it was a personnel file issue.
Mm-hmm.
That was and so he had leverage going into negotiations and got a full year, so roughly $300,000.
Okay, so we have $300,000 going out to relieve him of his responsibilities at the city. We have another $305,000 being paid to the city, the chief of police, because he was potentially going to sue the city based on texts sent by Tariq Bakari that he didn't like and he thought had damaged his reputation. But then as soon as he said yes to the $305,000, which includes a retention bonus, he said, well, I'm going to retire. So we've that going out, but he's leaving at the end of January. And then we have council extending Fox's agreement. They also paid him a retention bonus. And that's something that City Council's Dimple Ashmera found unpalatable.
Not comfortable with this retention bonus of $75,000. I need to see data from the public sector.
So, Mary, you were getting into this. Fox has been the interim attorney for 6 months. This extension will take him through the remainder of 2025. They paid him $75,000 in a retention bonus to stay, which he will receive if, in fact, he does stay. Is that normal?
That is something that multiple people on the council questioned. One of the other big things that came up in sort of the letter that council was presented on Monday night laying out Fox's new deal was that the city basically saying it's more economical to just keep him on than having to deal with bringing in private attorneys at an hourly rate to consult on things. And that got a lot of pushback, even from some of the council members who voted in favor of the deal, saying that's not a fair comparison. And you had some, including Renee Johnson, going so far as to say, and going back to how Steve started this conversation, why are we not simply elevating our deputy city attorney in the interim until we can get a hire completed?
Joe.
Yeah, that note, which was not public until the day after the city council voted on everything or the terms or anything about this other than just city
attorney. Did they know about it?
They knew about it because they had it in front of them, but it said that a private attorney would charge $395 per hour, and at 40 hours, it would cost the city $68,000 a month. And Dimple Ashmera and Ed Driggs were scratching their heads saying, what are you guys talking about? We pay the city attorney a salary. You should be comparing this to other cities with this position and how much they pay them for the position, not what you would pay a private sector attorney. But that's how the city justified this contract extension and $75,000 retention bonus.
So this agreement allows for him to leave before the end of the year should they find a permanent replacement. And evidently there's a search going on which has been suspended and then maybe restarted, who knows. It also includes a provision that if he stays in office through October 31st, he will be paid through the end of the year, even if he stops working in November or December. Mary, did this come as a result of his negotiating this, or was this just offered by council to I can't think of his name, Anthony Fox?
So just to address your point about the search, applications have reopened. They will close in 2 weeks, and council hopes to start interviewing candidates as soon as August. So that was sort of the update that was given on the timeline for the search. But with regard to your question, yeah, the answer from human resources staff when asked about that by council on Monday was basically Anthony Fox is someone who was on the verge of retirement. He was someone who was very clear when he came into the interim position. He didn't want the interim tag taken off at any point. He wanted to be here for a pretty limited time. So this was essentially needed to keep him and to sort of ensure a continuity within the city attorney's office.
So there was some pushback on council, which we've referred to, and we'll get into a little bit more of that when we come back. We have to take a break. It's the local news roundup on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from WFAE Center for Community Engagement with Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer. We were talking prior to the break about the City Council's offer to Anthony Fox to stay on as interim city attorney to the end of the year and the retention bonus that they paid him to do so. Renee Johnson is another City Council member who has a problem with this arrangement and who also has issues with the way in which the interim city attorney handled the settlement with CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings.
And I think this council needs to take a definite action to regain the public's trust.
So what specifically, Mary, as the local government accountability reporter, is she referring to?
So there were no specific references to the events of the last 5 or 6 weeks, but there were lots of references like that during Monday's debate, lots of recent comments like recent events, the last few weeks, things like that, which is pretty blatantly a reference to everything that's happened with the Chief Jennings settlement, everything that's been reported by every outlet you see represented here today about the ongoings with Chief Jennings' exit and the closed session agreement to pay him a large lump sum of money on his way out the door. Obviously, there's the lingering effects of the Patrick Baker exit as well, which we've already discussed. And sort of just the general reporting that I and others have done on delays with public records, meeting minutes, just a real lack of transparency from city government.
Yeah. Eric. And Joe, but Eric.
I just want to go back to what Steve was saying about sort of that private sector mindset with the interim city attorney. I mean, there are multiple occasions just within the press conference alone that was held after Councilmember Watlington questioned the legality and the processes of the council and basically said it was corrupt. Not basically, she said it was corrupt. And there were a number of issues that Anthony Fox said simply could not be disclosed publicly, that it was against state law to reveal this or that. And then it turned out that that was simply wrong. So, and as Mary just referenced, and we've all talked about on this show and elsewhere, the city has had years of not disclosing information or not disclosing it in a timely manner. So this is a sort of a peak private sector mentality, I would say.
Joe.
By the way, after that press conference, Anthony Fox told all of us that he was not seeking this position and he was going to retire after June. But this is another example for City Council of just the chaos and controversy that has plagued Council the past 2 years, because Council members, some didn't know that the search was paused. They wanted to know why the search was paused. They didn't know if the staff made that decision, if Mayor Vi Lyles made that decision when she polled Council members a couple of months ago. So there were a lot of questions about the process and who made that call and who actually is in charge.
Who did make that call?
I don't know. I really don't. I think that the city made the call after feedback from Mayor Vi Lyles, but it's not like City Council held a vote to pause it.
I asked the question because Council Member Malcolm Graham, who will be on this show next week, and we'll ask about that, and also Luana Mayfield expressed concerns that Vi Lyles, the mayor, had paused the surge, and if the search rather, and if that's the case, does she have the authority?
I don't think so. I really don't think the mayor can just pause a search without a formal vote. But if she says she got feedback from council members and maybe it's the city's call and the city was asking the mayor just for the temperature check, I really have no idea. Charlotte City Council has no idea. But then when we get to the vote, too, Dimple Ashmira was very vocal about how she was against the $75,000 retention bonus. She was not under the impression that it was included in the original vote, that the motion that was made, because the motion was just extend the contract. And so there, even though there were council members who were opposed to the $75,000 retention bonus, there was never a motion to actually remove it from the package or do a substitute motion without that figure because they thought they would have a separate vote on it.
So, Steve, clearly there's something going wrong on City Council. And if you agree with what Joe described as chaos on council, what's the source of the chaos? Is it our form of government where we have a weak mayor? Is it something else? What's going on?
I think that there's a sense among council. So just to back up, the mayor, her agenda and her what she wants to move forward always passes. There's always six votes. There's always a win. But the group of council members in the minority often feel steamrolled, unheard, left out.
But isn't that always the case in politics?
It's a very good point. I mean, you could say, like, look, this is how it is. I've got the votes. You can either get on board or not. That's a very fair point. But what has happened is some of the council members who don't have the numbers, Renee Johnson, Victoria Watlington, Tiawana Brown, et cetera, feel very, very frustrated. They want a process that's more inclusive. And because of that tension, you see a lot of things kind of boil over in public. And you get this back and forth in a very public way. Maybe it's inevitable. Maybe there's really nothing you can do about it. Maybe there is a way for the mayor to bring people along more. I that's really hard to say.
You mentioned Victoria Watlington, and this takes us back to Anthony Fox. She made the allegation several weeks ago that she had been witnessing over the past several months illegal and immoral acts occurring within city government. I don't know that she was specific about them happening on council or just in government at large, but she made those comments. And now Anthony Fox, the city attorney, wants to conduct an investigation into that, but she does not want him to conduct that investigation. Why not, Eric?
Because she is very wary and was opposed to the settlement with the police chief, Johnny Jennings. And so she feels like, you know, how can this be fair to have Anthony Fox investigating me when he knows, you know, that I'm skeptical, to say the least, of his tactics and the way he operates. And so she's saying, if there's a third party investigation, then I will cooperate. And one of the interesting things, Mike, is you're summing that up. Remember, first she says immoral, corrupt, all these horrible things. And then as the week went on, she kind of walked it back and said, well, you know, I don't like the way it's working, to what Steve was saying, you know, just the minority faction saying, the minority faction on council saying, we're not getting the information, we're not in the loop, so to speak. And so all these things are just in a constantly roiling cauldron, and that's what we've really seen kind of burst in an ugly manner before us here for the past couple months.
And these allegations came in an email that she sent to constituents several weeks ago. I've lose track of time. It's so many things are happening. But
on a fateful Monday night,
she wrote, over the last 5 years, 5.5 years, I have witnessed the brazen disregard and dissenting opinions and the rule of law and unethical, immoral, and frankly, illegal behavior. That has prompted the state auditor to say he, too, is going to investigate this. Where does that stand?
Other than the fact that there is an action, we don't know. We haven't heard anything about what's happening. And when I mentioned that press conference earlier with the interim city attorney, that press conference, if you remember, was held with Mayor Lyles and four or five council members and a couple others who weren't there but supported it. That was all in opposition to what Councilmember Watlington had said, and they were particularly upset about the allegation of corruption, because that obviously gets into bond ratings and all kinds of other things. And then I think, again, that led to her sort of pulling back a little bit and saying, well, not absolute corruption, but I don't like the way things are being done. And we have heard that for years, that everything is a last-minute decision, and I just got this information, and by the way, we got to vote on the Panther Stadium or whatever it is.
Right now. That happens right now, repeatedly. Yeah. Watlington has said, as you pointed out, that she will not participate in an Anthony Fox investigation unless a third party is conducting the investigation. He says... He emailed Watlington and other council members asking for their cooperation and said that the internal investigation would be Watlington's opportunity to clarify the statements that we've referred to, adding, quote, your refusal to meet will likely lead me to request that this matter be referred to an independent investigator at increased cost to the city. Well, that's what she wants.
She wants, right.
It's what she wants, but I'm not sure that council is going to move forward with that, because in that email exchange, some of the other council members came back and said, well, I'm fine with doing it in-house. And so I think if this ever does move forward and we do have this investigation, my sense is that a majority of the council, because there's always six, is going to say, like, no, look, let's find, we don't need, why would we want to spend the money, waste of time, et cetera, let's just take care of this in-house.
And it's interesting, though, like, we're getting into election season, and the city tends to pretend it doesn't exist when it comes to elections. Like, they want to stay out of things. They don't let council members do town halls. So it will be really interesting to see how the city would handle an internal investigation, because the city doesn't want to be seen as putting their thumb on the scales in these races.
Back up. They don't let city council members hold town halls.
No, the city helps council members hold town halls for like 18 months of their 24-month term, but mm-hmm. they shut down and they can't use city resources or broadcast on CLTGov or stream.
Haven't you noticed the hole in your social calendar for those 6 months?
Well, you may think that we're done with city council, but alas, we are not. There was another email that came out, I think this week, that Joe, you received from city councilwoman Tijuana Brown's campaign manager. That has caused yet another stir. What did the email say?
It was a press release that was very detailed. It was an official press release. It looked like everything else that Tijuana Brown has ever written and sent out before. And it detailed why she is not running for re-election. It made the announcement. It said she's not offering an endorsement. It said that this has been a really challenging time for her family, and she is going to focus on the future. But she says it was a test.
Yeah, this comes on the heels of a federal indictment that was handed down by the Department of Justice. They indicted Tijuana Brown and her two daughters for wire fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud. And the Observer, Mary, printed the entire email, which was addressed to her constituents. And that email clearly states, quote, "After much prayer, reflection, and deep conversations with my family, I have made the difficult decision not to seek re-election." But Brown says that email was, as Joe said, a test and was leaked. And she told the Observer that she sent that email to Colette Forrest, a former campaign consultant, adding, "She leaked it. Clearly, I cannot trust her." Talk about that.
Yes. So this was similar to Joe's experience. This email was sort of in the water system. So reached out to Councilmember Brown. She responded to me by text message saying, "I am away for my birthday, but I am running for re-election." And when we followed up, she again denied that the email was authentic and responded that it was a test to weed out somebody that she thought was being disloyal within her campaign. When asked who that was, she volunteered the information that it was Colette Forrest. Spoke to Colette Forrest. She told me that she has, throughout her time working on multiple campaigns with Councilmember Brown, that Councilmember Brown has sent her emails with the expectation that she will then distribute them to the media and or her voter database, and that there was nothing in the email that said, you know, confidential, eyes only, not for public consumption. So she felt comfortable that when Councilmember Brown came up during a conversation with a reporter, coincidentally, she felt comfortable mentioning the email, and that sort of led to it spilling into the public eye.
And there's an old saying, we don't talk to Joe Bruno. and she sent you the email.
So the email was blind copied. It wasn't like it was just sent to Colette. There was no way to see who the email was sent to. And it was addressed to supporters, colleagues, constituents. It very much looked like an official email. And there was nothing in the email that said, this is confidential, this is private communication, do not share this. This was presented as an official press release. It looked like everything else she sent. And so from Colette's position, like, Colette was like, I guess she's not running, like, that she, because she was texting me, and she's like, did she made the announcement today. And so she sent it to me. We reach out to her, we report it. We get messages saying, I'm running. This is a test. I don't want to be part of any situation like this. Let the record show. Like, I feel so like in between this drama right now. And, you know, we reported on what appeared to be an official campaign announcement. Right. Filing starts July 7th. It runs through the 18th. We'll see if she files. She says she's going to.
Okay, enough about City Council. Let's move on and talk about our second favorite body, the General Assembly. After months of nothing, now something. And Steve, I mean that there's now movement in the General Assembly on Charlotte's transit plan. A House committee met on Wednesday. What happened?
Yeah, this was a really big victory for the city of Charlotte, for the region. The city has been trying for 5-6 years to advance its roads and transit plan, and they finally really got some movement this week. The House Transportation Committee took only like 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, mm-hmm. It was really fast to unanimously approve a bill that would raise the sales tax by 1 cent to pay for roads and new trains and buses. This was Representative Tricia Cotham's bill from Matthews. There's also a similar bill in the Senate. I would assume that the bill that ultimately, if a bill passes, it will be Cotham will be given the credit. I think that Republican leadership wants to do that and spotlight her. I think one thing to note about the bill is that it did change somewhat. The original Tricia Cotham bill would have given a new transit authority complete flexibility on how they spent their money.
60% of the money.
60%, yeah. 60% of the sales tax would go to transit, and the original Cotham bill said that the new CATS, it would be a replacement of CATS, could spend it any way they want. This new bill puts handcuffs on how that money is spent. It
goes back to what we initially
40-40-20.
40-40-20. And Tricia Cotham, as you say, is the primary sponsor of this bill.
We're doing the tough work. We are doing the work what our locals have asked of this and giving them the opportunity to have this referendum put on the ballot.
We have been told repeatedly that this is going to be a tough sell in the General Assembly, and suddenly there's more buy-in than ever before. We have a minute left, Mary. Why? What's happening?
What really struck out to me from the very brief discussion in this committee hearing was how many members were repeating sort of Charlotte's talking points on this, that it's going to be good for congestion, good for business, that the business community is behind it, and that ultimately it will be the voters' decision because this is simply allowing the county to put a referendum on the ballot, not actually raising the tax.
And the House Majority Leader, a Republican from Columbus, Brendan Jones, says he supports the bill, calling it a good step forward to doing right by Mecklenburg. Well, there's the first. And he says the state can't afford to fund everything, but this bill gives the citizens of Mecklenburg an opportunity to have a say in funding their transportation needs. Something is going on up there. The dam has broken. I don't know what that is all about. When we come back, we're going to stay in Raleigh for a moment and talk about some immigration bills going through the General Assembly that went to the governor's desk for his signature and or veto. Did he? We'll find out when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins here with Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Mary Ramsey is with us from the Charlotte Observer. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. Around the nation, protests over ICE arrests have been proliferating. Los Angeles, obviously, is the epicenter, but not just for the protests, but for a test of the Constitution, as Donald Trump has called out the military and federalized the California National Guard without Governor Gavin Newsom's requesting their presence. That's in the courts now. It was suspended. The control was given back to Gavin Newsom yesterday evening, but then it was appealed by the Trump administration. Now it's back in the hands of Donald Trump, and it will go up the ranks. So with that as background, and because the General Assembly just sent two bills to the governor, Josh Stein, dealing with all of this. We've invited WFAE's race and equity reporter Julian Berger to join us for a moment. There are two pieces of legislation that have been sent to the governor for his signature. He had a signing event this morning at the governor's mansion. Did he or didn't he sign these bills?
No, he still hasn't signed it. And yesterday when I reached out to him, his office did tell me that he's still considering whether or not to sign these bills or veto them.
And you reported yesterday that immigration advocates are urging the governor to veto this bill, obviously. And there are several bills, and we'll talk about what's in them. Is he likely to listen to them?
That's the thing, we don't know. So his office did tell me yesterday as well that if an undocumented immigrant does commit a crime, that they should be deported. So this is more of a moderate stance that we've seen compared to our last governor, Roy Cooper, on immigration and immigrants.
So Senate Bill 153 is one of these bills. It's the North Carolina Border Protection Act. It would require state law enforcement agencies to cooperate with immigration enforcement. It would require participation in the federal 287G program. It would allow lawsuits against so-called sanctuary communities by victims of crimes committed by illegal immigrants. And it would bar schools in the state's university system, which means the University of North Carolina, from obstructing ICE. How would these requirements be different for law enforcement from what is happening right now?
Right. So this Senate Bill 153, it deals with state law enforcement agencies. So these state law enforcement agencies would have to enter into memorandums with ICE to cooperate with them to see if, for example, the Department of Adult Corrections, if they have undocumented inmates that are in their jails, they would have to give that information over to ICE and then possibly transfer them over to them.
Don't they already do that?
So they already do that, but this is more of a formalized process for them to do that.
The other bill is a House Bill 318. It requires sheriffs to notify ICE before releasing anybody in their custody who is there on a detainer or a detention request from ICE. A law passed last year requires law enforcement to keep those people in confinement for an additional 48 hours to give ICE time to retrieve them. Two questions. Why is this different? And the other question is, will anything change? Because sheriffs around the state say they notify ICE and ICE doesn't come.
Yeah, so the big difference here is those 48 hours will now be after someone is supposed to be released. So once that person is supposed to be released, that 48 hours will start. And then the sheriffs will have to notify ICE 2 hours before they're going to be released after that 48 hours begins to be like, hey, you know, we have this inmate, they're here. And that 2 hours is supposed to be before they're going to be released after those 48 hours.
So the Senate bill passed without any support from Democrats. The House bill had support from one Democrat, Carla Cunningham. Now it goes to Josh Stein for his signature or for his veto. Has he said anything about these bills? He didn't sign, nor did he veto them this morning, but has he said anything?
Yeah, so in his statement to me yesterday, his office did tell me that he's made it clear that if somebody does commit a crime and they're undocumented, then they should be deported.
Republicans no longer have a supermajority in the General Assembly, so they can't automatically override a gubernatorial veto. But House Speaker Destin Hall is confident that he will be able to do so if necessary because he believes he will have support by some Democrats.
I'm hopeful and optimistic that we'll be able to override. And with that said, you know, I'm hopeful and optimistic that Governor Stein may not veto these bills, but we'll see. I haven't talked to him about those things.
Is the fact that one Democrat in the House said yes to this bill, is that an indication that they may be able to override whatever veto comes their way should the governor veto this?
Yes, definitely. And that's what immigration advocates that I've been speaking to, they're kind of worried about. They're like, okay, if Stein vetoes it, then they do have Carla Cunningham who could help override that veto.
Protecting these people seems to be a campaign theme for Democrats around the country. Why would Democrats not support the governor's veto?
Yeah, so Cunningham, when I spoke with her about a month or two ago, she told me she is for immigrants that are here in this country, but that do it the legal way. So she wants people to have a legal pathway to citizenship, and those immigrants that are criminals, she wants them to be deported.
There were protests in Raleigh ahead of Tuesday's vote. There were also protests in Raleigh on Wednesday that coincided with protests in other cities around the country about what they call the campaign of fear against immigrants stoked by the Trump administration. And on Monday, several groups gathered to hold a rally in uptown Charlotte against ICE raids. How many people are turning out for these protests?
Yeah, it's happening all across the country in multiple cities. Thousands of people are showing out to these protests, and we're also expecting a protest tomorrow here in Uptown Charlotte, which didn't at first have to do with all of this immigration enforcement, but now a lot of immigration advocates are showing out tomorrow in support of this.
I want to talk about that in a second. The Trump administration has said it was going to round up and deport criminals, the worst of the worst. But it's become increasingly clear to a lot of people that that is not what's happening. In L.A. and other cities this week, ICE rounded up individuals at workplaces, on farms, at schools, etc. And now some industries, like the restaurant industry and the agriculture industry, are saying you can't do this because if you do, we will have no workers. We will not be able to harvest the food. And yesterday, Trump said we can't do this. Is that a glimmer of hope?
I don't know. We'll see. I think the biggest thing is that these raids, they don't just affect, you know, deporting people. It's the local economies that they affect. I put out an article about a week or two ago that it shows that local businesses are suffering because of raids that have been happening here in the city.
And as they pick up these people in smaller towns around the country, we are hearing from people who are shocked and appalled because they're looking at the people that they're rounding up, and they're not criminals. They're people who have contributed to the local economy, who have been there for 20 years, who they know as friends, as neighbors, as co-workers, and they're saying these people should stay. Is the political tide turning on this, or are these just isolated pockets where people are saying, no, these are my friends?
Yeah, I think people are starting to see people that they know that are being deported, are being detained. I mean, we know people that are construction workers that went to immigration court and were trying to do it, quote unquote, the right way, that were detained as well. So the numbers are rising and people are starting to learn about people that they know that have been detained.
Tomorrow is Flag Day. Tomorrow is Donald Trump's birthday. Tomorrow is the 250th anniversary of the United States Army, and in celebration of all of that, in Washington, there will be, for the first time in a very long time, a military parade, something we rarely see in this country or any other democracy, for that matter. But that is sparking reaction around the country. And here in Charlotte, Eric, there is something that is set to happen here tomorrow for what is happening around the country. No Kings protest. I learned yesterday that they're doing this in Great Britain as well, but they're not calling it a No Kings protest over there.
Charles doesn't like that idea.
They like the king.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is part of a nationwide protest, and I was just told before we started that it was supposed to be right behind this building where we're sitting right now, but it's been moved because the crowd is now too large.
Which is a sign of what we just heard discussed, of how this is gaining momentum when you see what's going on in Los Angeles. I think I just counted roughly 14 of these planned around the region in all the small towns that surround Charlotte as well as Charlotte itself. So, you know, whether this is a sustained awakening, we don't know yet, but certainly there is momentum, and it's being felt right here in Charlotte as well as across the country.
And across the area, because there are planned events in Rock Hill, York County in Rock Hill, the York County Rising, an organization, will participate in what they're calling the Kick Out the Clowns No Kings Day of Mass Defiance.
Does that mean we have to leave, kick out the clowns? I don't know.
Yeah, cumbersome title at best, but South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson has issued a public safety advisory warning, quote, that violence, vandalism, or obstruction of law enforcement will not be tolerated. Brian Ballard, who is helping to organize the York County event, spoke with WFAE about the Attorney General's comments.
Anything that is meant to make people fear coming out and exercising their First Amendment rights is just absurd, and it's not going to prevent people from showing what democracy looks like.
Do they expect that the Attorney General in South Carolina's comments will reduce participation?
I don't think we know, but it's clear that from everything that we're talking about right here, one of the biggest, the two big stories this weekend are how many people turn out at all of these and how do people behave, both security and protesters. And so that's what we're all going to be looking for, to see how people respond to each other and whether anything flares up.
So we've been waiting for years on movement on the transit plan in Raleigh. We have the kerfuffles going on with Charlotte City Council. Let's turn our attention to the Mecklenburg County Commission. The Brooklyn Village redevelopment project has been plagued with one delay after another over the course of about a decade. We have nothing to show for it. In April, the Peebles Corporation, the developer, told Mecklenburg County that they would not meet a July 28th deadline to demolish the old Board of Education, which is on that property. Steve, remind us of why.
Yeah, the contract that the Peebles Corporation, or, well, I guess let me back up. It would, on Monday, it'll be 9 years since Mecklenburg County selected the Peebles Corporation.
Happy anniversary.
To build Brooklyn Village. And Mike, as you said, nothing has been built. There is a part of the contract that says by July 28th, the old Board of Education building on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard has to be torn down to clear the way for the second phase of the development, even though the first phase has not started. Peebles says we can't make that deadline because there's asbestos in the building. Mecklenburg County says, you knew there was asbestos in the building. That's no secret. We told you. And they say their claim is meritless. And so what I think what's happening is there's been a lot of frustration over the years over the lack of progress. Now we have a real hard deadline that is coming up. Everything else has been very vague. And it's going to be interesting to see. The impression I get is that Mecklenburg commissioners, a majority of them, are fed up and ready to move on.
So the Brooklyn Village project was initially going to be a mixed-use project of retail and office complexes and residential, and then it's morphed over the last 9 years. And the latest proposal from the Peebles Corporation was to build 250 all-affordable housing units on the project. But they came to County Commission a couple of months ago, and they asked for $13.5 million from the housing fund to be able to justify that, to be able to do that. And the city said, no, that's too much money. And now they're warning that Peebles is warning that if they don't get the subsidization, they'll go back to their original plan and build luxury apartments. Don't they have to start building this summer to comply with the terms of the contract? This is a lot to grapple with in a very short amount of time, it seems to me.
Yeah, the contract does call for construction this summer, but there is some wiggle room. It talks about if market conditions allow, so that's a huge gray area. Peebles says market conditions do not allow us to build, even though, you know, we can all look around all over the city. I mean, there are apartments being built everywhere. Other developers have found a way to build things. Peebles has not. You know, and then they kind of made this threat. Well, we're going to go back to luxury apartments and the original project. Well, they couldn't do the original project either. I'm not really sure how much of a, you know, what's behind that.
And it appears that County Commission, Eric, is in between a rock and a hard place on this because they're getting frustrated. Nothing has happened. All the plans have fallen through. Not a single shovel full of dirt has been overturned. And Peebles has now, in an unsolicited email to Axios Charlotte, said that the company owns the land with no reversion provision for the company to take it back.
Yeah, and that's where this all seems to be heading, to Steve's point. I think he was hinting at this, is that you're coming to a collision point, and it seems like you're likely to have a fight about that land, the ownership. Maybe you get into how much the county might pay to reacquire it if nothing is going to happen, because it certainly looks like a standstill and a standoff. And you're right, Mike, it's gone incrementally. They keep taking steps, but nothing happens. And so here we are 9 years later. I got to let Joe say something.
Very quickly, Joe.
I talked to Peebles yesterday, publishing a story today or Monday, whenever I get the chance to. But he told me you could put a gun to his head. He will not be demolishing that education building by the end of next month.
Okay. In January, Mecklenburg County conducted their 2025 point-in-time count of people experiencing homelessness that was conducted on the January 22nd through the 25th, and now the results have been released. Liz Clayson-Kelly with Roop Above spoke with WFAE about the conditions they experienced that night.
We had 110 additional people on overflow beds that evening. So I did anticipate our unsheltered number would be lower. So when we see the significant increase in unsheltered homelessness, despite how cold the temperatures were, despite having no turnaway at shelters, it's deeply concerning.
So the survey shows that 60 more people compared to last year's count were homeless, with 116 people newly identified. And Kelly says the increasing need is causing Roof Above to feel the crunch.
We definitely are feeling on the front lines the increased demand, and as well as our increased limitedness in terms of what we're able to offer people.
And so part of that has to do with the fact that there are more people here that are homeless, and part of the fact is there are a reduced number of beds. And we'll end on a happy note, and that is that the Charlotte Checkers are continuing their winning ways, and they're in the Calder Cup Finals. We just want to let you know that. Thanks to everybody on the panel, Eric Spanberg, Mary Ramsey, Joe Brugo, Steve Harrison, and Julian Berger.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.